This is You've Binge Challenged. I'm Craig Collins, and I'm really excited, which I say every single week, but I actually took about a month off because Patty and I were talking about something, and I thought that this has to be the first podcast I do with Patty Vasquez. You challenged me to this show. We did actually record a different podcast already, The Flash.
It's not my fault you're being very honest, because I'm being too honest.
No, it's totally fine. No, so we recorded a different one, and I reluctantly kept it. I kept thinking each week, like, I should post this one, I should post Flash, and then I said, no, I'm going to wait to get Patty Vasquez on to talk about Fargo.
Because that's the one you asked me to.
Yeah, exactly. And what's cool about Patty, when you do my show, is that you actually bring along a sidecar, which is very typical of our radio show we do from 11 to 2. John Tatey is also here to talk about Fargo.
Hi. Well, hi, everybody.
He's the reason either one of us watched it.
Exactly correct.
Is
John Tatey?
So?
Yes.
You are the AV Club Grand Poopah, and I think I give you a lot of other titles in my introductions,
yes,
but what do you do over there?
I am the editor-in-chief at the AV Club,
nice.
And in regards to Fargo, I actually recorded video commentary each week with a colleague of mine, Gus Bellman. We call it Polite Fight, because we sort of politely disagree over certain interpretations
awesome.
Of the show, but I really regard it as an enhancement to the show. After you watch an episode,
correct.
Go on AV Club, search for Polite Fight, and you'll get insights into the cinematography, into the editing, into the scripting, just things that we notice.
All the fancier stuff.
All the fancy stuff.
All the fancy stuff.
I'm just like, it was cool.
It's funny, because when I watch something live, which is not what I do for this podcast, this is all binge stuff, so I saw all the episodes of this in a row. Mm-hmm. It was 10 episodes, each about an hour, although the time really fluctuated. There were some that were 47 minutes and then some that were 55 and a half minutes.
Yeah.
But when you watch something each week, I tend to do that a lot. As soon as it ends, I usually jump on and try to find as many things as I can to read about what smarter people than me said about what happened that episode. So is that something you guys also do?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have our reviews that go up pretty soon after the show airs, and mm-hmm. then this video series I'm talking about usually goes up, that episode will go up the next day. We're just trying to enrich pop culture
yeah.
for people, and you know, it's our job to look at this stuff closely, so you can watch it leisurely and then benefit from our sort of intense viewing.
Well, plus it helps with all the names. Like, I get really bad at some of these shows at keeping track of names, but for me, I actually end up I watch a bunch of these episodes more than once.
Oh, wow.
I really, really enjoyed this show, the way it was shot. Maybe because I was really little in the 70s. So some of it, like, you know, I was a kid around this time. So it sort of spoke to that for me, the cars and the clothing and all
nice.
The music in the background.
And actually, that's usually how I start off my podcast, is I ask the person who challenged me to the show what it is that made you pick this show specifically. Because for my podcast, you get to pick anything you want. And we even actually talked about doing Gilmore Girls, because we are both very unapologetic fans of that show.
But how this is so much more
but
consumable.
This is, yeah, and well, what was nice about this and most of the podcasts I do is, if I've never seen it at all, and I never saw the movie, I never saw the first season, and they're all very connected, apparently, the first season and the movie.
I love this so much more
than
the
movie. And this plot line, yeah.
Love it so much more than the movie. I don't. I mean, I just did. The acting was... It was amazing. Gene Smart and Ted Danson was great.
Yeah.
I don't know the names.
Ted Danson for me was the biggest surprise.
It was a surprise how good he was?
Yeah. Well, he's a talented comic actor, and I have nothing against Ted Danson, but I didn't expect the level of heart and subtle sweetness that came through this character. I mean, don't you love that scene early on where he's talking to, now I'm going to forget all the names.
See, it's hard. It's very hard to keep up.
Pachichi.
Yes.
He's talking to, who's the main cop character?
Oh, his son-in-law, you mean?
Yeah, his son-in-law.
I'm pulling it up now, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I know his last name is Lou Salverson. He's talking to Lou Salverson, and he wants Lou to talk about his experience in Vietnam, because mm-hmm. Ted Danson's character Hank was in World War II, and he
mm-hmm.
feels that they could share something. And I just love the sort of Midwest manly way, but still sweet, heartfelt way he kind of pushes on Lou and tries to get him to come out of his shell.
There are some elements where they'll touch on what it meant for these men to come back from Vietnam differently than the men who came back from World War II, and the sort of violence and the upheaval that we were experiencing socially, economically, and politically, you know, because I watched this a little bit out of order. I accidentally watched the second episode first.
That happens.
Yeah, well, because it was at Mark DiCarlo's house,
nice.
And that was I could have sworn he had all the episodes, but it was just four, I guess. I ended up watching four in a row.
Of season two.
And then later realized that the pilot, the premiere episode was actually this sort of throwback to a Ronald Reagan movie. It was alluded
to. That was the very first scene, yeah. I mean, it was sort of this waiting for Godot setup, except they're waiting for Reagan instead. And it sets up this, this sort of social backdrop of the season, which is this sense that the country is waiting for Reagan. And it's exploring why that is. And it's this really sophisticated treatment, I think, of how Vietnam, you know, Vietnam doesn't come up much explicitly in this season, but it's there because we know it affected the psyche of Lou. Mm-hmm. We know it affected Hanzi, the quote unquote red man, very deeply. And you can see
and
how
the lawyer, who's the comic
Nick
actor?
Offerman's,
Nick Offerman's character, which is amazing. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Lawyer. Yeah, he's great.
Yes. And he's questioning everything, right? He questions every supposed reality, especially as it pertains to government. So you can see how Vietnam has twisted the American psyche
interesting that you mention the American psyche, too, because we actually have a very specific American psyche reflected in this show. We have a very small town, very rural area. Mm-hmm. So it's not, I don't think, what the whole general populace of the country at that time might have been thinking or the exact way that we all were interpreting this. It's coming from this small town mindset, correct?
Right.
And that's something that I found fascinating right from the beginning. There's an episode or there's several moments where the good guys encounter the bad guys. And in some shows like this, you would think that eventually that will end in shooting and killing and death.
Right.
And actually, quite a few times, it does not. They have very manly, as you would say, conversations, very intimidating conversations.
Yeah, very tense.
And that seems, I don't know if that's also a reflection of sort of a small town environment. I don't know if people could be that disrespectful to police officers at the time, and the police officers could be that intimidated, and they all just kind of go their separate ways, and nothing results after the fact. Because there's a lot of moments where you think this is really intense, and then it's almost forgotten.
Like with Lou, when they come to the typewriter store, correct, and he's like, we're all just going to walk over. I'm just going to back out of here.
Yeah, we're all just going to back out of here.
Yeah.
Right. You just said you're going to kill a cop to his face, and everybody's just going to forget about that. So that is a very interesting kind of component to every episode of the show.
Yep.
You know, that is, to me, a manifestation of a dynamic that runs through the whole season, which is this sense that we're on the brink. And Lou often says something like, when are we going to be free of this craziness? And how, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he has that scene with Reagan in the bathroom and he's just talking about all the madness and where do we go from here? And so I think that those standoffs are sort of a tense, compact manifestation of that, in that it seems that we're on the brink of absolute chaos. It seems like Lou is going to get it in a shooting fight twice in that episode, because he also goes to the Gerhardt compound in that same episode that has the typewriter. And there's two standoffs in that episode. And I just, it amps up this feeling of we are on the verge of a complete breakdown, which of course that complete breakdown kind of takes place.
Does take place for the end, which is, that's amazing.
Great,
It's so interesting to me too, as you say that like that, because they all know that this is coming, I guess, but they're not exactly shying away from it and they're not exactly trying to create it. In every single moment where these cops are interacting with the people who will inevitably all blow up and kill all these people, they continue to not back down, but not actually pull the gun completely out and start the fight themselves. It's such an interesting way to develop that. And then, as you said, Patty, Hanzi is an incredible character. Oh. This guy at the start of the show is a bad guy. He's not a good human being. He's working for one of the families that is, you know, creating a lot of the chaos in the area. And yet, by the end of the series, I really, really like him. There's something about him that I'm like,
really?
Yeah, I do. I like the
simpleness of
completely understand why he goes after everyone after the fighting, after all the chaos, why he's still trying to kill two of the lead characters. And this is a spoiler happy kind of podcast, so we can spoil everything. But at the same point, we don't need to get too much into the details of it. I don't understand why he doesn't, because the idea is that this guy kind of decides that he's going to go out on his own and kind of just drop everything he's doing. And he actually causes the violence that kills all the people that he's essentially working for.
Yep.
I don't understand why he would still want to take the lives of what would be the sort of innocent characters that are being into everything.
The woman in the hotel room where he tries to find out where Kirsten
Yeah, that's terrible. Yeah.
There's a lot of moments you're like, huh?
Why is he doing that?
Well, do you think he just really snapped at the bar when he saw the plaque for Remember Wounded Knee? Was it?
I think that's a pivotal moment. I would draw a connection between Hanzi and Peggy in this season, because these are two characters, both of whom are sick and tired of having other people tell their stories for them and having this story prescribed to them, right? Which Peggy expresses rather explicitly, I don't mean she uses
in the final
bad
episode,
language,
yeah.
but rather straightforward in a rather straightforward manner in that final episode. So I think that that's the base frustration here, is that there's this set of narratives that are just sort of automatically applied to women or to Native Americans that they are fed up with at this point.
Thank you. That's why I like him so much, actually. It's the scene when he goes into the bar, like you said, and he is being treated really racially inappropriately, and he takes everybody's life, but he reacts the way that in that time period probably was very difficult to react. The same with Peggy, although by the end of the series, I don't like Peggy at all a person. She seems...
Peggy's cursed and
really? Terrible. Yeah.
I never liked her.
I never lost my affection for Peggy.
She drives home with a guy in her windshield.
Yeah, that makes no sense.
It goes inside and makes dinner. I mean...
yeah, okay. And at some point, we're going to have to talk about this part. And I mentioned this to you, John, when we saw you this week for Patty's show. I kept feeling like I was watching episodes of Twin Peaks in a way. I had just done Twin Peaks. This actually is the last podcast that you've been challenged people will see before this one. So I'm also kind of glad that Fargo's coming next. It was interesting, the alien dynamic in the show,
that was weird,
which
yes.
is so mm-hmm. mildly thrown in there in a way that I think if it were actually an episode of Twin Peaks, that would be a much more dominant aspect of the season.
Absolutely.
But it's was that an homage to that show, putting in kind of that extra unexplained weird stuff?
I would hesitate to call it a homage because... you know, I think that David Lynch he specializes in this sort of alchemy of the bizarre, putting these highly idiosyncratic characters and settings together and seeing what happens.
Yeah.
And I think that the presence of the aliens is more purposeful in Fargo season 2. And the way I talked about it on the site in our Polite Fight videos is I kept coming back to, are you laughing because I'm plugging myself?
Polite no. I'm laughing because I like the Polite Fight name.
Oh,
I just like that name.
Okay.
No, please plug away, John.
But, I often talked about this feeling of the sense of the spectator that the aliens impart. We have all these squabbles going on and all this complicated web of interests and violence that's happening on the ground. And I think that the purpose of the alien presence, which is never really explained in plot terms,
not at all,
is to force us to pull back and think about, well, what do the aliens think looking at all this?
Right.
And that pivotal moment in the second to last episode, how do the aliens show up? They throw spotlights down
Why?
On everything.
Over the motel.
Right?
Why do they choose that moment to interfere?
I think that they are choosing that moment to watch. I don't think that they're...
Oh, I think that's different, though, because you can watch from your giant... And if they've been observing the whole time, they must have been watching some other way to actually shine the spotlights to... create reactions from the people to, I guess, you know, demonstrate that they exist at that exact moment seems to me to be either just coincidence or purposeful.
Well, I think it's because it's the climax of this conflict. And to me, the effect of the spotlights as a viewer is to look at what's happened. Like, this is the outcome of all this. And I know I'm being kind of wishy-washy here, but I think it's more... It's a sort of an ethereal touch. I don't think there's anything concrete to the aliens.
But,
go ahead.
Well, I'm just thinking here. Patty goes up on stage. She does a comedy show. A spotlight shines on her specifically. The spotlight is not on everyone in the room. The aliens do not shine a spotlight on the entire thing. There's more
specific
people being highlighted. Why are those specific people highlighted? Why does that happen? To me, I guess you could call it a MacGuffin in this scenario, like a literal exactly what that is, because it's not explained at all. It definitely... benefits the plot on that one episode to prevent the main character from being killed. It seemed purposefully out of place in a way that David Lynch would do it to me.
You know, I think that the spotlights come in at that moment. To me, it felt kind of like the aliens were saying, enough. Like, enough.
Stop, please.
Look at what has happened here. This is enough. This can be the ending of this story. And it basically is.
That is interference, though. That is not observation.
Well, I didn't say it wasn't interference. I think it's the interference of the spectator, though. Having someone watch you changes the way that you do things. And I think that it's this overt spectating at that moment.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the other times that the alien ship it becomes an element.
The murder in the beginning.
Motel.
Murder.
Which she's driving. So is it only when Peggy is there?
No. So actually that's what distracts, I guess you're right, because she does hit him with the car, but that's what distracts the shooter in the first place. He looks up and sees the aliens and then he gets hit by the car.
Right.
So that's why he's even out on the road to begin. I don't know. I guess they could just be following Peggy.
Could it be Peggy's part of the story? Because it's supposed to be based on real events. So who was the storyteller in this?
Is that true though? Is that just a joke? It's not actually based on true events. Is that?
No, it's a joke, but I'm saying
but it's supposed to be. Yeah, I got it.
If it's the people that were involved in the story, who is the one that the story's coming from?
Well, and it's interesting you say that
too. Who's the observer?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that too, Patty, because Peggy is the one in the moment that reacts to the aliens as if everyone knows they exist.
Right.
Because when everyone else is stopping, she's like, oh, it's just the aliens. And she keeps going in that episode. So you're right. Maybe she...
It's her part of the story. Right. And then there was an alien ship. Mm-hmm.
Well,
right?
I think not even that. I think Peggy immediately dismisses the alien ship as irrelevant to her self-actualizing narrative.
I like
so
that better.
Why
does
she concern herself with
my
it?
One of my favorite lines is Ted Danson saying, you're a bit touched, aren't you?
Interesting. I took that moment as familiarity, as she actually understanding or knowing more. You take that as her being so self-focused, which is what the character
has
is,
nothing
that
to
she
do with
doesn't
her.
Even give a crap about aliens.
No, it's it's not relevant to her, to the story she's building to herself at that point.
That is awesome.
Yep.
Yeah, I really think that's it. And I would mention also that the alien ship did come in at other points throughout the series.
Kind of,
there was one episode that ended with this pullback camera move that is clearly from the perspective of the alien ship because we see this green lens flare that's kind of associated with them. Don't forget, when Hanzi is looking for clues outside the Waffle House, time stops for him for a second. And again, we get the sort of green lens flare effect. So he was kind of visited, or time doesn't stop. Actually, time speeds up without him realizing it. These hours pass without him moving, which is sort of this odd effect that the aliens have also of time compression that I never quite got my mind around either.
Yeah, no, there were so many elements that were both grounded in just so much tension with the butcher when he's chopping up the guy who was in the windshield. I can't remember all the names, but the finger's on the floor and Lou comes in and you're just waiting for and he's kicking the finger.
By the way, that actor who plays Ed, Jesse, he is
from
Friday Night Lights. He also was a murderer in that show, if anyone remembers.
He kills the rapist.
Yeah. He did,
Even Friday Night Lights tried to forget that.
Yeah. Friday Night Lights begged to forget that.
Such a jumping of the rapist.
Yeah, exactly correct. It's just so interesting that he played a similar character in one way and the fact that he's trying to deal with a murder.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you watched Breaking Bad, but Jesse Plemons also played a character on Breaking Bad that murders a child.
Oh my God.
So,
And then deals with the fallout of having lived through that moment? Or
Not really.
He's
that
less apologetic?
Yeah. I mean, Jesse Plemons has such this sweet middle America
he
face
does.
That I think that writers just love to turn him into this sinister figure.
I have to say one of the briefest scenes and strongest for me was Ann Cusack as the judge who ultimately sets all these things in motion.
Yes.
And she pulls out the bug spray and she sprays him with it.
Yep.
And then she sees the gun and she goes,
oh, crap. Yeah. She's like, okay, I misjudged this whole situation.
Yeah.
Well, and she talks. Ann Cusack, to me, creates a nice bridge from season one, which I don't know if you guys have seen the first season.
No.
Is she in that?
She's not, but she tells this story about the devil, right? Before, what is his name? Rye Gerhardt shoots her. And the first season was very concerned with this notion of the devil because Billy Bob Thornton character's Lorne Malvo was really cast as this satanic figure. And that speech, to me, not only was it so wonderful in the moment and just a great cameo, I guess you'd call it, by Ann Cusack, but it's provided some connective tissue to me for the first season, which I highly recommend you go back and watch.
Well, they do that on purpose. The movie is connected to the first season, connected to the second season.
Yes.
Even the Lou character is in 9 of the episodes in the first season.
Oh, he is.
Yeah.
Oh, good. I have to
he actually even references, and this I think this is where the writers got the idea for season two. In the first season, he tells a couple stories that are a little bit mysterious about the massacre and about some other things that he experienced. And then for season two, they're like, you know what? Let's go back in time and give this guy a whole character thing.
Interesting.
Yeah. Develop his character
that
way.
I look forward to that.
Yeah, if you go back and watch season one, especially if you watch it soon after having watched season two, you will see a number of thematic and explicit connections like that, references that are hidden throughout. I mean, it's such an intricately plotted and considered show, I think, because the showrunner, Noah Hawley, pretty much writes everything himself.
Oh.
So it is really coming from the mind of one extremely talented writer.
Have you seen how the Coen brothers feel about the TV show?
How do they feel about
it? Not fans. They say that it's fine. They say that it's okay. It is what it is.
Hey, you said something free.
It doesn't have to be too connected to their stuff, and they see their own thing as very independent of whatever's happening on the TV show.
They can go sit at the little boy's table with George Lucas.
Well,
just
in fairness to the Coen brothers, they kind of took a Peggy vis-a-vis the flying saucer attitude to Fargo. They were just like, we didn't really watch
whatever.
Television. Yeah, that's basically. So okay. They didn't say that it was bad at any
I thought that was a very tongue-in-cheek way to say we don't really like the fact that this is on television. Now, what do you guys think of the show? Well,
so.
We don't really watch it. We don't.
I so enjoyed it. I loved watching it back to back. I watched like 4 or 5 episodes in a row. And the black actor who is also gives these like monologues.
Yeah, Bokeem Woodbine.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Oh, so good.
Okay, so there's a moment where he's quoting a poem. He's quoting a poem. I can't remember what
Jabberwocky.
The poem is right now. Thanks, yep. The Jabberwocky. That was so powerful. That has to be the most powerful way that's ever been used in television, I think.
I think you're right.
Because he's saying this nonsense poem and he's actually setting up to go kill a bunch of people again, mm-hmm. right? That's
yeah.
what he's doing?
Yeah.
That was one of the most intense moments of the whole season for me, is that retelling of that Jabberwocky. I don't know why he would think of that. He's such an interesting character, the complexity of the biggest murderers in the show.
Every time he's on the screen, he's telling the story about the coffee maker at the typewriter shop,
yeah.
and I'm all in. I'm like, tell me more.
Absolutely.
What?
I love Mike Milligan, and I think that Noah Hawley realized after the episode started airing what a magnetic character Mike Milligan is,
because
he kind of tails off toward the end of the season. We don't see much of
him,
although the one moment when he stumbles upon the massacre there and just says, well, okay.
Okay,
and
great.
Walks away is just one of the great moments of the season. But I do wish we'd gotten a little more Mike Milligan.
And then the way he ends in the corporate office, he thinks he's getting a promotion.
Oh, that was so funny. For them to actually put a literal, you know, this is an office and we're trying to hit our bonuses and trying to hit our quotas
mm-hmm.
for this, you know, mafia group that
right.
it felt like, and I've seen it called this before, maybe even on the AV Club, it felt like the Walmart of the mafia was fighting this tiny little store.
The mom and pop.
Yeah, the mom and pop shop.
That's
and
right.
that's what
that's
he eventually Gerhard's just work? Takes an HR position. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, you know, I really liked that because I think Mike... There's this scene shortly before that off him in the office where he's in the episode before where he's sort of taking his gun out and spinning it and playing with it. Like he always has to be practicing his gun skills, always be getting better at this sort of desperado style, justice dealing that he does.
Right.
And then he gets to this office and all those skills were useless. He thought he was becoming, you know, the classic mobster.
He was ascending to some higher.
He was ascending to some, you know, higher badass, I guess. Can I say badass on the.
You can say badass, yep. You need to say that on the radio.
And then he ends up in this office job, and to me it's just of a piece with everything else that suggests a break from the past at this moment, that this is a pivotal moment in the culture. But what was interesting is a lot of our readers did not like that ending for Mike Milligan, maybe because they loved him so much and didn't like to see him end up this way. But
they set it up so well with
earlier
when they had the guys on the window washers come in through the window.
Yes.
Right.
So you already
and kill
know,
a bunch of people, yeah.
Yeah, you already know there's sort of this corporate element to this mob, right?
Right.
So I thought it was set up pretty well.
Well, I thought it was executed really well, especially with the fact that when he wins, air quotes, whatever, because he's not actually the one that's defeating any of the people, he assumes the home. He starts to make plans for what's going to happen. And even in that, when he's walking through the little building, he starts to try to talk about what his plans are when he goes back. So I thought that was executed perfectly, that he has these expectations. The viewer, not knowing what's coming, thinks that, okay, yeah, he's assuming the role of head of that organization there in that position.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just put him in an office with a telephone.
Oh my gosh.
To me, it was amazing. And I think it says a lot about organized crime, especially at that time too, and how
sure it does,
much it permeated every part of our society. That was the game.
Well,
the
it's kind
goal.
Of a Godfather-like message where this melding of capitalism and crime to the point where the line between them is indistinguishable.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I found it fascinating. I loved the show.
I was
so grateful. I usually at some point in the podcast ask And I know there's a lot that we leave out. There's sometimes characters that we don't even mention at all. Is there something that you think, Patty, since you challenged me to this, that's missing so far from our conversation?
Well, the only thing I was, I loved every actor in this series except for the guy from Burn Notice, who I watch every episode of Burn Notice, one of my favorite shows. And I, the Gerhardt, the oldest Gerhardt.
Yeah.
Dodd.
His name's Dodd.
I think his name is Donovan.
Jeffrey Donovan.
Mm-hmm. I was so disappointed in his performance. I know you're supposed to dislike him anyway. I've watched him in so many other things and enjoyed him for so long that it almost seemed too stylized. It was the one thing that took me out every episode. When he was on
his
screen,
his delivery. You mean?
Yeah, his delivery was just like, it was almost like he was trying too hard. I loved every actor. I thought that's what kept bringing me back.
Huh.
Was the writing, was the, you know, we were talking about Bokeem Woodbine. What's his name?
Bokeem Woodbine,
yes.
Yeah.
Gene Smart and Kirsten Dunst, who, you know, you think of her and Bring It On, and she's so great.
Yeah, she's so much more dynamic than
every actor just was delicious. I thought the writing was fantastic, but also the cinematography. You know, even the moment where Bokeem is getting sugar for his coffee and you follow the spoon into the granules. Yeah. Like, and the scene where the uncle's taking his niece out to offer in the woods. There's so many beautiful...
Oh my God, that scene was so powerful, the way that they did that. And so,
and I've spent so much time in North Dakota and Minnesota.
Oh really?
So the way they shot the winter there was, I loved all of that.
Visual component to the show is another thing that reminded me of David Lynch as I'm watching it. I know that they didn't do it the same way that David Lynch would shoot something, but just the amount of maybe care or thought they put into some of the things that were surrounding the people at the time.
The ice, you could see how many, the aerial shots, you could just see how deep the ice was on the roads. Yeah. I loved all of that.
Yeah.
Well, and even the narration, the episode where they actually go back and do the massacre, the big, giant, crazy, everyone dies episode, the way that they chose to have a narrator kind of read from a book, that was a really cool, that's the right episode I'm thinking of.
It is, and that's Martin Freeman, who was the season, who was the narrator in that. Can I do my
please, John, go ahead.
Lingering observation, which is that I would say if you're going to watch this, the biggest theme I would have you keep in mind as you watch it is that this season of Fargo is about the power of narratives and the detachment, the sort of postmodern detachment of narratives from truth. I think we get that with Reagan, where he has this new story for America, and you have Patrick Wilson, Lou Salverson, questioning him on the reality of it, and Reagan is just kind of befuddled by it because it doesn't it doesn't matter.
It doesn't register. Yeah, he's like, what are you talking about?
All that matters is that he's telling this story that resonates.
Yeah,
and you have Hanzi reacting to the stories that are told about him. You have Peggy seeking to tell a new story about herself. She has all these magazines around the house, and these are just her collecting stories, trying to invent some new tale for herself.
That's great.
So I think if you watch it and think about the stories that the characters tell about themselves, the stories that they have told about themselves, that other people tell about them, then I think that will deepen your appreciation of the show and how the complexities of the stories that are being told in these people's lives.
Yeah, that's a really amazing point because in all honesty, the way that even the mafia, the Walmart mafia, would shape the history of what's going on, they have such control over that it can become part of what everyone thinks actually happened. Yeah. There's a lot of corruption, and that says a lot about a lot of things, John. Thank you. I'm thinking about a lot more now.
They determine the rest of the story.
My brain just blew up at the end there. Well, cool. Well, thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you, Patty, for doing You've Been Challenged in Fargo Season 2 specifically. And thank you, John, for being her sidecar.
Oh, my pleasure.
And for recommending it. It was all based on your glorious, expounding.
I made a difference here.
You made a difference.
You really did.
You made me think thoughts. All right, this is You've Been Challenged with Craig Collins. Come back next week where I think I will share my Patty Vasquez episode of Flash, or I will start doing my Game of Thrones podcast. I'm going to do Game of Thrones, John. I actually should have you be a guest
season
for one
by
of these.
Season?
I'm going to do week by week, so 7 episodes at a time. I'm going to have a specific guest come in and talk about just those 7 episodes. It starts now, so it'll actually end.
I'd love to do one of those.
It'll actually end the day of the premiere.
There's too much mud.
Thank you again. You've been challenged, Craig Collins. See you next week.